Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm happy to welcome back to the program today Dr. Jason Bird. Jason Bird is the Associate Director of the William R. Maple Center for Forensic Medicine. And Dr. Bird has been on the program before, and we've talked about what he does, which I should caution the audience listening today. We may be talking about some things that many of you may find disturbing. I have made it a point of saying on this show before that we talk about the health and welfare of animals, and today we might be talking about some instances of animal cruelty. So just bear that in mind as we proceed here along. Dr. Bird, welcome back to the show. I'm glad to have you here.
Thanks for having me back.
You are the Associate Director of the William R. Maple Center for Forensic Medicine. That is an institution here in Gainesville that does something really quite special. Can you describe the mission of the Maple Center?
Sure. Well, the Maple Center was created in the name of Bill Maples, the legendary forensic anthropologist that worked as faculty here at the University of Florida for many years. And the Maple Center is out of the College of Medicine. And the Maple Center is kind of a specialized unit where we specialize in forensic sciences and medicine. And the difference between forensic sciences and medicine is relatively simple. If you're trying to figure out the cause or mechanism of death, that's forensic medicine, and everything else is forensic science. So fingerprints, for instance, would be forensic science. So our specialty is forensic medicine and pathology. And as a result of our specializations, in 2009, through multiple requests from really private practice veterinarians who are trying to come up with answers of the cause of death of animals, they asked us if we could implement an educational program for veterinarians that would help them in their animal cruelty casework. So we started doing that in 2009, and we were trying to take what we know in human forensic science and medicine and apply it to crime scenes, essentially, that involve animals. And we've done that in kind of a multi-pronged approach. We've started a educational program at the master's level. We do workshops in person where we have veterinarians come to Gainesville and we teach them how to process animal crime scenes. And now we have a case response mechanism where through a partnership with the ASPCA, we respond to law enforcement requests for specialized assistance with animal death investigations, essentially. And we roam the country assisting law enforcement in their complex and complicated cases dealing with animal cruelty.
A naive question. But what happened before this was available to law enforcement?
Well, prior to our 2009 implementation of this program, it was kind of up to law enforcement to scratch around, usually in their local communities, find a veterinarian who might be interested in helping them with their casework. And everybody was kind of on their own. So law enforcement didn't really know how to vet a veterinarian, whether they were really qualified to do forensic work. And many of the veterinarians who wanted to help law enforcement in their community really were unaware of all the questions that can come up in the legal system, the challenges of integrity of evidence and courtroom testimony. So, often just because of our legal system, many of these cases never went to prosecution because a very astute attorney could poke enough holes in the case as to get the or keep the physical evidence out of the courtroom.
I think everyone listening to this show is someone who loves animals. And so none of us wants to imagine animal cruelty. And I'm sure that the scope of it is atrocious. But let us talk about how this benefits law enforcement, because it is, I believe, in my personal opinion, it's so crucial to prosecute these kinds of cases because it's just so reprehensible. We all know animals are basically defenseless creatures. So when these kinds of cases arise, you will probably receive a phone call from what, a law enforcement agency?
Yes. Generally, it's an investigator or a crime scene technician with a law enforcement agency, and they're either on scene dealing with a problem or know that, there is a an instance in their community of, say, maybe someone who's an animal hoarder, animal rescue that has essentially failed and turned into a hoarding situation, or in many cases it may be organized animal fighting, fighting birds or dogs. So it's usually the investigator who knows that they have something in their community that they need to deal with, but are also aware of the fact that the resources, their law enforcement agency or county or city animal services probably isn't equipped to deal with it. So they contact us asking us for two things. One is advice on how to deal with it, and then the second thing is help to actually come in and assist.
So let us take a hypothetical case here, something like dog fighting, which I think is shocking and pretty deplorable. When you receive a phone call, probably law enforcement has been on the scene of some place where they have discovered that dogfighting has taken place, right? They may have already arrested some individuals. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, often this comes in as a complaint. Either, a neighbor complains of the number of dogs on the property, or often it may be, a member of the dogfighting ring itself complain. Law enforcement is usually at the time they contact us in the process of trying to establish probable cause, to help make the case. And through our partnership with the ASPCA and a lot of the legal resources that an organization such as the ASPCA can provide, they often help law enforcement with legal consults, developing the probable cause, and then come up with a plan that, once a search warrant is executed and people are arrested, that the animal evidence is not only adequately documented, but taken care of. It is very unique in the world of forensic science to have live evidence, so to speak, that can't be packaged and put into an evidence vault to await trial. They have to be cared for. There's certainly an expense in that, and that requires specializations, as well as the veterinarian's ability to document the condition of the animal. And it isn't just the condition of the animal when you're on scene that is documented. It's also how quickly that animal improves once it is provided, proper medical care and proper housing. Because one common defense is that the animals are old or sick, and they look that way due to some sort of a natural process, not anything that the owner of the animal may be doing. And when you can demonstrate the rapidity with which an animal recovers from being taken out of that situation, you can often disprove that defense.
That makes perfect sense. You remove a dog that has been in a situation of suspected dog fighting. The dog probably looks pretty rough at the time. Now, someone might claim, this animal, like you just said, that's just how this animal looks. But removed from the setting in which the suspected crime was taking place, the animal begins to recover, look better, look happier, and then you can clearly demonstrate that there was some at least negligence going on and perhaps something even worse. The ASPCA and investigators trained through the program you're discussing today, they probably are well aware of many of the signs that some kind of crime has occurred. You come upon a scene and you might find what? Animals in pretty rough shape, I imagine.
Yes, and we have to go in with a very diversified team. We, as forensic scientists, can help law enforcement recognize particular items of evidence that they may overlook, such as the paraphernalia that may be around that people use to train fighting dogs. It's often very innocuous. It may be a treadmill, like you or I would commonly exercise on in a home setting or a gym. It may be springs that dogs are trained on, or some sort of a ginny mill that the animals are put on and exercised for long periods of time. So law enforcement will typically overlook that, and we're trained to pick up on these physical items of evidence that may be indicators of animal fighting. But we fall short, we as forensic scientists fall short when we turn to, you know, the live animal and the evidence that needs to be documented there. So we have to bring specially trained veterinarians on scene who then focus on the animal itself and removing items of physical evidence from the animal, such as embedded collars. With fighting animals, it's the weight of the chain that the animal is on, length of the chain. You know, those items are documented and weighed. And then the forensic veterinarians go into, you know, the documentation of the overall health of the animal, the scarring, how old the scarrings are, and where the scars are actually documented, because that can help prove animal fighting. And all of that goes beyond the capability of a typical, you know, crime scene analyst with your municipal law enforcement agency. So they welcome us on scene because we often generate much more physical evidence that can be handed over to the prosecution than they would have been able to generate if they were just trying to do this case on their own.
Now, having an animal that is just not well taken care of in and of itself may not constitute a big crime. Unfortunately, people may just neglect their animals. It could perhaps be argued by someone who, was being investigated, I just haven't been able to take care of this dog as well as I would like, but thanks to the training that forensic scientists have and people, other team members like you were describing, who come on the scene and say, but yes, it's not just that this dog looks like it's in rough shape and it's been neglected or even, you know, probably not taken care of very well, maybe even treated cruelly. It is that there are these other components here on the scene that point to something specifically criminal. And when it comes to trial, if these cases ever come to trial, are experts able to go and give testimony before a jury to say, these things were found on the scene. We know from experience that these components are generally evidence of a crime?
Oh, absolutely. That's a routine part of the job, and maybe one that isn't reflected too much in popular television shows that are on the air. The expert witness aspect of it is a huge part of the job. All of this ends up in court with a prosecution of a human, more or less. So even if it could be simple neglect, unintentional withholding of food or water from an animal could still result in a criminal prosecution, with varying degrees of sentencing that could be expected, as a result of the trial itself. But we, as forensic scientists, would go and testify as to the physical items of evidence that we recovered from the scene. The forensic veterinarian would participate in the trial as well to talk about the health of the animal, but they could also identify, so in organized dog fighting, for instance, a lot of medications that may be found on scene that may be only obtained by prescription. So then you have to answer all the questions of how did they get the prescription, who issued it to them. So you follow the kind of the source of the medications, for instance. Breeding records, fighting dogs are only worth as much as their pedigree. So dog fighters take special care to document the lineage of the animals. So all of that comes into play, and all of that is in the realm of the forensic veterinarian to provide that type of testimony in court.
Are there instances that you can recall in which a suspected dogfighting case that the defense has argued that it was something other than dogfighting?
Oh, that's very common. Common defense arguments are it's not actually a dogfighting ring. It may be a breeding operation, for instance, so it's to justify why you have 150 dogs on your property. Of course, breeding animals isn't illegal as long as it is done appropriately and local ordinances are followed. A breeding operation is another one. From the damage that may be done from fighting to the individual dog that may be questioned, so the scars that may appear on a dog, a common defense is that it resulted from, a typical encounter. I was walking my dog at the park. Another dog got off leash and attacked my dog. And that's how my dog has all these scars. But fortunately, our veterinarians that we work with have done a good bit of research on these common defenses and have determined that the scar patterns are different in or what you would expect to be occurring in a dog fight, an organized dog fight, versus when two dogs kind of randomly scrap it out at the dog park for a little bit. It's a different type of engagement between the two dogs. The scars are in different locations. So that's all stuff that a well-trained forensic veterinarian can point out to a judge and jury. And those are the types of things that we try to train veterinarians to do.
In your experience, is this expert testimony met with do juries generally believe the expert testimony? Are these cases prosecuted successfully?
A lot of these are prosecuted quite successfully. It turns out that the testimony from veterinarians are very well received by juries. And often, whatever the veterinarian has to say on the stand is believed by the jury. A veterinarian is a pillar of society and quite trusted. So prosecutors are realizing that now, and if they can integrate the actual testimony of a veterinarian into any sort of animal neglect or cruelty case, it generally comes out much more favorably than if the veterinarian does not appear as an expert witness.
Now, I think we can all agree that in, of course, the American criminal justice system, every defendant has the right to capable defense and counsel, and I don't want to believe that anybody is sort of being not given a fair trial, but some of these cases are probably so egregious that any evidence is just going to be so damning. I imagine that the juries see photographs. Are the investigators on the scene not only collecting the animals and other paraphernalia, but are they documenting the scene with photographs or video?
Oh, yeah. We process scenes for animals exactly as we do any human crime scene. The subject may be a human or an animal, of course, but the prosecution is always going to be towards a human. And that human may be deprived of their liberty. They may have severe financial fines levied against them due to acts of animal cruelty. So it always comes down to the prosecution is going to be against a person. And if a person is going to be prosecuted, then the science that generates the evidence that leads to that prosecution has to be done regardless of what the victim may be. So we don't do animal scenes to any less scrutiny than we would a human homicide just for that reason.
I think that that is encouraging to hear. When we talk about a case like animal hoarding, this is something that I have to imagine at some level is both upsetting and sad, and also can probably in many instances provoke sympathy, at least for the person who is hoarding, simply because I imagine animal hoarding to be a kind of situation that someone doesn't deliberately fall into. Probably no one sets out to say, I'm just going to collect as many animals as I possibly can. It may begin innocuously enough. It may begin even with good intentions. But in your experience, how do some of these cases really proceed from something sort of benign to something kind of just beyond acceptable?
Sure. You know, I would say a lot of the animal hoarding cases that we have interacted with are misguided attempts to do good. So they start out trying to shelter a few animals and then end up just not being able to say no, take in more, get in far over their head to what they could, you know, safely have space for or financially provide medical care for. But along with that also comes some sort of a behavioral pathology where in doing that, they feel that they're still doing good for these animals and they are taking better care of the animals than anyone else could or would. So they're very protective of the animals, often do not relinquish the animals voluntarily, And because they are often seen as, you know, somebody trying to do good, providing, you know, homes for animals, even though they may lack the basic care an animal may need, often there is certainly a component of the community that does support them and protest very intently any attempts to go in and move those animals to another location. So yeah, it happens all the time. And one strategy that has been developed for that is to come up with an intervention program where if the person is willing, people can enter the property or dwelling and provide medical care for the animals, maybe do spay-neuter of the animals to keep the population from growing. So at least the problem is managed on some basic level before it turns into, you know, what could be a criminal situation that involves search warrants and seizure of the animals and then a criminal prosecution.
Let's take a little diversion here. You mentioned warrants. How critical is the opinion of some forensic investigator or a forensic veterinarian into the procurement of a warrant? Should law enforcement maybe be alerted to something, a suspected crime, if they don't necessarily on their own have the kind of expertise necessary to really make a solid determination that, you know, what has happened on the scene that involves animals necessarily rises to the level of criminality? Are experts such as yourself important when it comes to securing warrants for investigation and searches?
Sure, that's a good question. There's a number of different strategies for that. So say, for instance, law enforcement could develop probable cause to enter the property on a completely unrelated event. It may be an outstanding arrest warrant for, you know, another criminal activity. It could be an inspection of the property on a codes violation. And if they can gain access to the property legally on one probable cause, then, of course, one strategy is for the investigator who's on property to, you know, document as much of the scene as they can, come up with a way to legally get a veterinarian on property to look at the animals. And then once, the animals are, you know, briefly examined, then a warrant can be drawn up to seize the animals based on, you know, their health assessment done at that period of time. And it also goes the other way. Law enforcement may be interested in an individual because of their criminal activity far beyond, say, animal fighting. But they know they're fighting animals, and in the grand scheme of things, the animal fighting may be the lesser charge due to the criminal activity, so they may get a warrant on the property for the animal fighting, gain access to the property based on that, and then as a result of those searches, seize drugs, illegal weapons, and be able to make arrest based on that. So sometimes the animals are the end cause of that probable cause and warrant, and sometimes they are the start of it to get to some other criminal activity.
How, I don't know a lot about the law, certainly, but I wonder, you mentioned, you know, law enforcement getting a veterinarian on the scene, and is that generally achieved somewhat easily, or is there, from a legal perspective, you know, if law enforcement is executing some sort of search warrant for like a codes violation, are they allowed to bring a veterinarian on scene if they suspect that something has gone wrong involving animals?
Well, they may not be able to bring the veterinarian on scene, but they can certainly document what they see while they're on scene and provide that evidence, either video or photographs, to a veterinarian who can then make some determinations based on the visual evidence. And other times it may be relatively easy, such as an animal hoarder or a puppy mill, for instance. You might be able to do a staged buy. So the buyer of the puppy is actually your forensic veterinarian or investigator. So they're legally on the property to make the buy, and then being legally on the property, then anything that they see that's in plain view at that point in time, including the condition of the other animals, could be used as probable cause for a later warrant to come in and seize the animals, or at least do an intervention where the animals are given medical care, and the owner of those animals has the opportunity to surrender or forfeit those animals.
You brought up puppy mills. You mentioned earlier that breeding isn't necessarily illegal. Is there a distinction between an animal breeding operation and a puppy mill?
Well, it's vernacular. So we call them puppy mills quite a bit, simply due to a breeder that may have substandard conditions. So the act of breeding in animals is certainly not illegal, as long as that breeder follows whatever county codes, city codes may be there, or guidelines established by the state for animal welfare. So as long as the breeding operations are in the best interest of the animal, essentially, and they're well cared for and not neglected, little that can be done about a operation, no matter how large it is. But size doesn't matter. It's how well they care for the animals.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFTFM. I'm Dana Hill speaking with Dr. Jason Bird, Associate Director of the William R. Maple Center for Forensic Medicine at the University of Florida. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. Today we're really talking about animal welfare because my guest is Dr. Jason Bird, Associate Director of the William R. Maple Center for Forensic Medicine at the University of Florida. And we're talking today about the investigation of crimes involving animals. This is a pretty sensitive topic, so I'd advise those of you who are listening to use your best judgment, because we're talking about some pretty upsetting things, especially for an animal lover to hear. So, Dr. Bird, when we left off, we were talking about the investigation of, say, you know, breeding operations that are not really up to standards. We talked about some dogfighting, and we talked about animal hoarding. There are probably circumstances in which none of that really is at play, but in which there is either just flat-out animal cruelty, or there is some other crime in which the law enforcement arrives on the scene and discovers that animals are involved in some way, shape, or form. Does that happen?
Oh, sure. It happens on a small scale as well as large scales. They may be involved in a death investigation of a human on the property because of that death investigation, and discover that the person had, you know, a large collection of animals either for breeding purposes or curiosity, and then have to, you know, immediately do something about those animals to be able to give them care. And, you know, you may discover a criminal activity associated with it, such as dogfighting, or you may discover a hoarder. So it's a fairly common instance for law enforcement to be on scene for another reason and discover animals in crisis.
And as we discussed, they reach out to now what is available to them through a program that you're involved with, and they are able to find expertise from veterinarians and forensic scientists to make a determination about how the animals involved in the case have been treated. We talked sort of at the beginning about veterinarians performing investigations to determine the cause of death of animals. Now, everyone who is listening to the show will be aware from TV, of the medical examiners that do autopsies on human beings that have died under suspicious circumstances or just unknown circumstances. When we talk about animals, is it common for an animal death to bring about what is it called, a necropsy?
Yes, exactly, yes.
Is it that common for that to take place in the event of an animal that's perhaps been found deceased on a crime scene?
Sure, that's a standard part of the examination. And, you know, one problem that we have found out since we started this program, at least in the veterinary medical sciences world, we do have veterinary pathologists. And just because you're a veterinary pathologist does not necessarily mean that you're well-versed in the forensic exam, forensic necropsy, for instance, or postmortem examination. So we have to train pathologists and other veterinarians who are non-pathologists to be able to adequately perform a postmortem examination on a deceased animal or a forensic exam on a live animal. So that process and that medical exam that has to happen to generate evidence is kind of a cornerstone of our program to be able to teach veterinarians to do that. And unfortunately, there are no forensic science programs that are required curricula in any vet school in the United States. If they have it, it's often an elective, and very few vet schools in the country offer it as an elective. So most of the veterinarians out there who attempt to get into a situation in their community where they can assist law enforcement usually have to learn how to do it, how to apply forensic science and medicine well after they've received their degree. And that's why we have so many DVMs or DVM equivalents come to us to be able to learn how to do that, because they very much want to help animals. They very much want to assist law enforcement in their local community. But unfortunately, just haven't been trained well how to do that in a formal DVM program.
Tell me about what that training looks like, because some veterinarian that may have, you know, been trained in the course of becoming a veterinarian to understand, you know, reasons animals might die of natural causes or what have you, may not necessarily be trained initially to look for some of the signs of, say, criminal activity. How does this program go about teaching that? What are the veterinarians taught to look for?
Well, several things. It's multifaceted, for instance. So in the role of a pathologist, you know, you have to be able to notice, recognize, and diagnose natural diseases. So you have to know what's normal before you start recognizing the abnormal. So you can't get very far away from your natural disease background. We teach them how to recognize trauma. Sharp force injuries, blunt force injuries, gunshot wounds, teach them how to collect evidence of, say, gunshot wounds and gunshot residue. We spend some time teaching them about scientific and legal principles of evidence, how you actually have to physically handle the evidence so that it legally stands up in court. We teach them basic crime scene methods, the same that any other crime scene investigator would go through. And then we get into the veterinary specialties, such as the live animal exam and documentation of evidence from live animals. The other thing that the veterinarians have to worry about that, you know, is not so much in human crime scenes is the environment that the animal is in and how that environment could have impacted the animal's health or emotional well-being of the animal. So we often have to get the forensic veterinarian on scene so they can look at that environment and be able to convey that information to a judge and jury, because many animal cruelty laws do take into account the mental suffering of the animal. So it's not just the physical scarring that may be present or the medical condition. It may be the emotional state of that animal, and however the veterinarian can document that animal's emotional well-being, usually best done at the scene. We need to figure out ways to be able to do that and actually get the veterinarian with hands on the animal before it's ever removed from the scene so that type of documentation can happen.
So let us go back to our hypothetical dogfighting investigation. The veterinarian may be able to make a determination about whether some of the dogs that are found on the scene, even if they don't bear outright signs of physical abuse, they may have been in confinement, they may have been intimidated, they may have been kind of tormented by the environment in which they'd been placed, or maybe the treatment they received at the hands of human beings, or just the threat and danger associated with having to fight other dogs. Are the investigators, the veterinary investigators on the scene, able to kind of take that and go to the jury or the judge with a description and say, yeah, these dogs are very scared. They've been not only traumatized physically, but kind of emotionally, they've been compromised to such a degree that perhaps they will not be able to have normal lives after that?
Sure, those are all components of the program. Everything about the dog's behavior is documented, whether it's aggressive towards people, whether it's aggressive towards another dog. You'd mentioned its confinement, so the type of enclosure it's in is documented. It's measured, so we know how long it is, how wide it is, how tall it is, and then we know the size of the dog in that space. Its food and water availability is documented. And the dog, once it's removed from the scene and gets into a shelter where, you know, it's essentially held as legal evidence, other professionals come in who are behaviorist, animal behaviorist, and then they start an assessment of the animal on its current state. They often try to, over time, rehabilitate that animal and actually get it so that animal could eventually, once it's adjudicated and released as evidence, be adopted out as an animal that could go into a home, possibly a home with children or even a home with other animals, and live out a normal life. So, yeah, we cannot forget the role of the animal behaviorist in helping these cases come to a very positive outcome for the animals.
That's encouraging to hear. Now, you mentioned to me earlier that your center now has the ability to do some things that perhaps the last time we spoke was not an option. And you mentioned wildlife. And I wonder if we can talk a little bit about how there may be investigations concerning wildlife. I'm trying to think of some examples of what you might be called out to a scene involving wildlife and what that might involve.
Sure. It's along the same vein as what we do for companion animals and farm animals with our associated program with the ASPCA. With wildlife, we often partner with government agencies. And most of those cases are poaching, illegal take of wildlife out of season, for instance. And we now have a genetics lab, so we can do animal DNA work, and that's even open to the public if the public has an animal DNA question they want answered. But it may be illegal take of wildlife. So Fish and Wildlife may find meat in a freezer, and the suspect could identify it as beef. It goes to our DNA lab, the meat is sampled, and if the meat turns out to be in a protected species, such as a gopher tortoise, that's fairly commonly made into hamburger meat, particularly here in the southeastern United States. Or it may be a deer, and it may end up being a female deer, and that may have been taken out of season. So we can provide genetic evidence as to what the tissues may be if we don't have a whole animal. Another thing that we're commonly asked to do is hunting equipment, trucks, and four-wheelers that may have animal blood on it to try to determine what species that blood is and if it's a protected species. So you may not have the whole carcass of the animal present, but if you've got blood of a protected species on a piece of equipment obviously used for hunting, then that may be enough to use as physical evidence in a criminal case.
That is absolutely fascinating because I imagine that the first few times these kinds of cases were prosecuted, the criminal suspects must have been astonished that they were able to be prosecuted in this fashion. They might have never imagined that these tools were at the disposal of law enforcement.
Yeah, they do not think, well, not all of them, of course, but many of them do not think that law enforcement can apply or will apply the same level of science to an animal case as they do a human case. So they often make no attempts to hide some of the evidence. We had one person who illegally took an animal, actually drove it back to their house to slaughter the animal, but it was fairly close. And they hauled the animal in an open bed of a pickup truck, The animal apparently had multiple gunshot wounds, and law enforcement was simply able to follow the physical trail of blood from the pasture where the animal was shot to the home of where it was slaughtered. So that was a low-tech crime scene procedure. You just follow the very visible trail of blood.
When criminals don't suspect that law enforcement would devote resources to the prosecution of an animal case, it makes me wonder why perhaps that is believed, right? Is there any indication that law enforcement in general is less inclined to prosecute a case specifically involving animals that may not involve any other, let's say, human-on-human crime?
Well, you know, I think I hear that a lot, that, you know, oh, it's just an animal, therefore the case won't go anywhere or not be prosecuted. But in actuality, we found that very little. Law enforcement actually is quite proactive in prosecuting or wanting to prosecute animal crime, but they just have to connect all the dots. So the scene has to be processed correctly to provide the evidence. The evidence then has to be handled in such a way that it's still legally viable and valid to present in court. So you have to hand good evidence to the prosecution. And if the prosecutor can get it, usually the municipality will take it to trial. I'm sure there are jurisdictions who would not be very proactive in animal crime, but fortunately, for most of the work we do, we find jurisdictions, as long as they can be provided with very good evidence, are very willing to move forward with a prosecution.
How far afield are investigators trained in your organization going? Is this mostly throughout Florida, or is it elsewhere in the Southeast or in the United States?
Oh, it's certainly nationwide. We have veterinarians from all over the United States come into Gainesville to take our workshops. Our student population taking our classes is distributed fairly evenly throughout the United States. We even have a number of international students in the UK and Australia and Southeast Asia. But it's certainly here in the United States, very nationwide. The program partnership between the University of Florida and the ASPCA is nationwide. So we roam the country assisting law enforcement whenever it's requested, as long as the probable cause is there and the jurisdiction's willing to move forward with the prosecution.
If we can go back to the DNA work just a little bit, we all have seen the shows. We've all watched, say, trials on court television and have watched as prosecutors or defense refer to blood evidence or DNA evidence. And anymore, I mean, DNA evidence is so critical to the prosecution of crimes that it's gotten to the point now where I sometimes even feel a little bit uneasy when I hear about cases that have been prosecuted that don't involve any sort of DNA evidence. So trusted now is DNA evidence. When you're prosecuting a case involving animals, the blood evidence or other tissue evidence, is it taken back to a lab and is it compared to some sort of standard that an investigator could say, I know for a fact that this is, say, alligator DNA or this is bald eagle DNA somehow?
Oh, sure. There are a number of databases out there for species identification. And so it's twofold. One is, you know, what is it? So bald eagle or alligator, or take, for instance, a domestic dog. So that's step one. You get your species determination. And then in some cases, we have to go a bit further, say, for instance, in, a dog attack case. So we know it's a dog, and we have to get exemplar DNA from the dog that possibly attacked the victim. And then we can do an individual match. So we could say conclusively that the DNA recovered from the victim matches this animal. And then we have to try to associate some statistics to that to help assure the jury that, you know, we can determine that animal from all other similar species in the population. So we routinely get into an argument that may be very familiar with a lot of people that happened in the O.J. Simpson case. What is the probability that you can determine that individual out of the population? So we still go through that quite a bit if an individual identification on an animal needs to be done.
Are juries typically Are they typically comfortable believing not just veterinarians who you say are well-trusted, but the DNA evidence that is provided that involves animals? Or are they somewhat surprised that this technology exists at a level involving animals and not just human beings?
Well, I think they're surprised at times that it exists, that the information is out there. But once presented to them appropriately, I think it's relatively rare for the juror, the trier of fact, to doubt that scientist.
So as we kind of wind down the show, and we've got a little bit of time left, you mentioned that the public can get involved in some way in this DNA or genetic component of the work that is now available through the Maples Center. How exactly can the public be involved?
Oh, so we set up the DNA, animal DNA service, really as a resource for law enforcement, because oftentimes, you know, law enforcement can't go to the state crime lab with an animal case. State crime lab won't take those cases just due to the case load and case priorities. So we started as a resource for law enforcement. But after we started it, we quickly realized that there's a lot of people in the public who have questions and would like questions answered, and genetics can shed light on those questions. So we often have public coming to us with a case request, and that may be that their cat was attacked by something. They found their cat deceased on their property, and they want to know what type of animal attacked it, or could it be even human intervention that led to the demise of their animal. So we can do that in many cases. Of course, cat attacks, maybe dogs. We've even had small dogs attacked by birds of prey. So we've been able to get the DNA information from a bird of prey, from deceased dogs. So we find ourselves routinely working cases brought to us by the public just for public knowledge. They want to know what killed their animal, and they pay for the service, and we do the case for them just as we would a law enforcement agency coming to us.
Well, that's fascinating. So let's imagine an instance in which an animal is found deceased, say, in someone's yard. Now, I know that even in my neighborhood here in the city of Gainesville, I have seen a number of critters that could potentially prey on other smaller animals. I've seen owls, I've seen hawks, I've even seen a fox in my neighborhood. Now, any one of those animals, if attacking, let's say, a domestic animal, might leave some sort of telltale signs. Can you describe what an investigator might look for to determine whether the attack was caused by, say, another dog, which we consider, of course, a domestic animal, or, say, something a bit more wild, like a bird or a fox?
Sure. Well, it's twofold. First, we like to bring the remains of the animal back into the laboratory, where we will have a veterinarian do a postmortem exam. So we actually look for the puncture wounds. We look for the pattern injury that may occur. So we visually examine the animal and try to document that. And then while that exam is going on, we make DNA swabs from the areas of those punctures. We look for fluids that may be present, such as saliva on the fur of the animal. And then we collect all of those DNA samples and send them to our geneticist. And then the geneticist ends up doing, as we talked earlier, identifying the species of animal out of large genetic databases that are out there. In cases of, say, a cat attack, if we determine it's a dog, sometimes that's as far as it goes. The neighbor just wants to know it's the dog and not the maladjusted teenager down the street. But if it is a dog, then you may want to know which dog. So you may have what you think to be a particularly aggressive dog in your neighborhood. And if we can get genetic swabs from that dog, we could either include that dog as a possibility or exclude that dog. So it really just depends on how far the owner of the animal wants to take the testing.
And the public can reach out to your center how?
Sure. They can go to the UF homepage at ufl.edu, and in the search box, just type in Maple Center, and we will pop up. And all our genetic services are listed on our center homepage.
As far as the future of this kind of science and the Maple Center in general, Where do you see this technology going as we move forward in time? It seems amazing that some of this exists at all, and it probably down the road just gets more advanced and your capabilities get even better.
Yeah, it's true. The science is very new, and we're constantly doing research on how to better apply what we know and even develop new techniques. But animal crime, unfortunately, is so egregious in our society. Our efforts now are focused on trying to get similar programs set up, and particularly with other universities around the country, so that we aren't the only ones doing it. And we would all like to be able to put ourselves out of business because there are no cases of animal crime. That's our eventual goal, but unfortunately, we're a long way from that. So if we can get local communities to set up resources within their area to help combat the incredible amounts of animal cruelty and neglect that we do have, that's what we're going to try to do.
Well, Dr. Jason Bird, Associate Director of the William R. Maple Center for Forensic Medicine, thank you so much for coming in again and talking with me about this. It's a subject that, I find so, I have so many feelings about it. Of course, we all abhor the idea of animal cruelty. I imagine that for someone like you and the folks who go through your program, it must take a big emotional toll to see some of this stuff. So thank you for the work that you do and for helping train others to do the important work of prosecuting cases of animal cruelty. It's such an important thing. Thank you.
Yes, thanks for having me back.
I want to say thank you so much to Sarah Carey and her staff over at the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Dana Hill. I hope you'll join me again next time for another episode of Animal Airwaves Live. Bye-bye.